Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Every July 4th, in honor of Independence Day, I like to feature an interview that takes us back to the good old days of the American founding. 2 years ago, we featured Mark Hall discussing how the founding fathers viewed church-state separation and how that concept has been viewed throughout our nation's legal history. Last year, we aired two separate interviews with John Fia and Mark Hall on how much Christianity influenced the foundational documents of the United States. That was an interesting debate, and our new listeners might want to track those podcasts down via our website. We'll make sure that we link to them. And it was during my discussion with John Fia that I asked what I thought to be a rather innocuous question of whether or not he would have picked up arms as an American colonist to fight against the Redcoats. He answered, no. Given that my initial inclination would have been to grab the nearest musket and join the local militia because there be fighting to be had, I must admit that I was surprised by this answer. And over the course of the past year, I probed a number of historians and political scientists about what their answers would have been to this question, and was shocked to find that very few academics would have joined the Patriot forces. Perhaps this is not surprising, given that it was estimated that roughly one-third of the colonists were patriots, one-third loyalist, and the other third indifferent. This whole issue came up again at a recent conference panel at Gordon College, wherein a number of academics smarter than I started to debate the merits of the Revolutionary War, with reference to various intellectual sources, including Christian theologians and the Bible itself. Since most of that discussion went way over my head, I interrupted the conversation to ask each panelist whether or not they would have joined a colonial militia to fight for independence after the first salvos in the war were fired at Lexington and Concord. One panelist was a firm no. Two others answered yes. And a third wallowed in the ambiguous middle, which was pretty frustrating since it was just a simple yes or no question. Following that panel, Mark David Hall, someone who has come to be my July 4th go-to guy on this podcast, suggested I should do a podcast where these three positions are debated. I thought it was a great idea and was able to secure his participation as well as those of two other scholars. The rules of this debate are fairly straightforward. Each participant will be asked the same question. As a Christian in the American colonies, would you have picked up arms against King George and Britain to fight for independence following the battles at Lexington and Concord in April 1775? Each participant will be given 20 minutes, give or take a minute, to make their best case from a Christian perspective. The host, that's me, reserves the right to ask a few probing questions during the interview so as to keep the discussion conversational. Our three participants were interviewed in mid-June at their convenience. None of the participants were allowed to hear the other responses. The order in which the interviews appear in this podcast will be determined at random based upon my son throwing hatchets at a picture of King George III at a log in our backyard. We will post the photos of this endeavor on our Facebook page, so if you want to see how those results turned out, please show up at our Facebook fan page and like us so that you can see those. At the end of the three interviews, I will share some of my brief thoughts on the topic. Listeners are welcome to chime in with their own views on this question, either at our main website, www.researchonreligion.org, or via our Facebook fan page, which you will have to like before you can post. So take a few moments to register your opinion, as I would love to hear from you. Our three guests, in order of appearance as determined by the hatchet throwing, are Professor Greg Fraser of the Master's College in Santa Clarita, California, who will be representing the no position to our aforementioned question. Professor Jonathan Den Hartog of Northwestern College in St. Paul, Minnesota, will represent the yes response. And finally, Mark David Hall of George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon, will take up the banner for the nuanced and squishy middle response, which is largely a wait a bit longer than Lexington and Concord so as to exhaust all other nonviolent options but keep the musket within arm's reach. So without any further ado, let's begin. Here to speak for the no position on going to war, we have Professor Greg Frazier, Professor of History and Political Studies at the Master's College in Santa Clarita, California. He is the recent author of The Religious Beliefs of America's Founders, Reason, Revelation, Revolution, which we will link to on our website, so please do check it out. I should note that Professor Frazier's book was the subject of the panel which I referred to in our introduction. That's the panel that generated the debate over whether or not Christians should go to war in 1775, 1776, etc. Greg, welcome to this special edition of Research on Religion.
Thank you very much.
As I will do with our other guest, Greg, I pose the following question to you. As a Christian in the American colonies, would you have picked up arms against King George and Britain to fight for independence following the battles at Lexington and Concord in April 1775?
Yeah, my answer would be definitively no. I would argue that participation in the American Revolution was wrong for believers because the Bible teaches that participation in any revolution is wrong. So really, the particulars of the American situation are irrelevant. But I think it's hard to call their situation tyrannical at that. But I wouldn't focus actually on the particulars of the American situation because I think the Bible clearly teaches that believers are not to participate in revolution, period. And so it doesn't matter whether it's that revolution or any other. The Bible uses some form of the word rebel or revolt 142 times, all in the negative. Because authority and authority structure is very important to God, whether it's the family, the workplace, the church, or the government. And Romans 13:2 is crystal clear regarding rebellion and revolution. Paul there says, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, I might add, therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. And the therefore is important. It refers back to verse 1 of Romans 13, which says, let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. So Romans 13:1 unambiguously says that all governments get their authority from God. Paul says it three ways so that people won't miss the point. He says every person, that's everybody under any system. He says no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. So Romans 13:1-2 makes subjection to government absolute. There are no exceptions.
Okay, let me pause you there a minute, because when you started off here, you said Christians are forbidden to participate in any revolution or rebellion. And I think those terms revolution or rebellion are critical here. We didn't use the term war. Is there a difference in your eyes, your perspective, between a revolution / rebellion and war?
Absolutely.
Okay. What would be the differentiation then?
Because in a revolution, you are under an authority that you are trying to overthrow. You're under an authority that you are declaring to be illegitimate and attempting to remove its authority. But its authority doesn't come from you. It comes from God. And that's not your option. A war is a battle between or a fight between two independent sovereign entities. And so that's an entirely different situation.
Well, let me push you on that because, again, and you make a very compelling case from the Bible about rebellions and revolutions, but we might have to take a look at the Revolutionary War and wonder if that's a revolutionary rebellion or a revolutionary war. The colonists, yes, technically were under King George, but were they growing apart? What is there a certain point in time when these two entities, the 13 colonies, are really so distant apart from the seat of power in England that the two are actually separate and it could be considered a war?
I think you could make that argument. I think it's really problematic because, once again, it's not up to the biblically speaking, it's not up to the people to decide that a government is no longer legitimately over them. The government is given authority from God, not the people. And it seems to me, if you're going to make that argument, you would have to say that the Confederate states were right in rebelling against the Union. They declared themselves a separate nation. I mean, maybe you'd want to say that, but I don't see why distance particularly matters. And if it does, then what is the distance? Is it 1 mile? Is it 20 miles? Is it 300 miles? Is it 3,000 miles? The issue is they were under the authority of the king and parliament. The king and the parliament never released them from that authority, and so they were under their authority. And just simply declaring yourself independent doesn't make it a reality, as we know, because the war is called the War for Independence. So they fought the war to make their independence a reality.
Let me also ask this. As you talk about it was not in the colonists' purview to determine the legitimacy of the government. Does this give a justification for divine right kingship, in your opinion?
Sure, if you want to put it in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just divine right kingship, it's divine right republican government, it's divine right every kind of government. The governments which exist are established by God. They have their authority from God, and the form is irrelevant.
Is there any point in time or any particular level of tyranny that could justify a rebellion?
Not from a biblical standpoint.
Okay.
One of the key differences is who holds governments accountable. Biblically speaking, God holds governments accountable. God removes authorities when he wants to remove authorities to fulfill his plan, or when they're not doing what he wants them to do. But that's up to God to decide biblically, not up to man. He has the authority to do so. Men don't. And it's instructive, by the way, I think, to note that Nero was the emperor over the people to whom Paul wrote the book of Romans. And if Nero's not an exception to the rule, there's an entire branch of theology which says that Nero was the Antichrist. If Nero's not an exception, I don't know who would be. I think it's also important to note that Jesus himself affirmed this principle in John 19:11, when he affirmed to Pilate, a lowly governor over a conquered people in an obscure corner of a pagan militaristic empire, who was not elected or popular, that he had authority over Jesus himself from God.
Mm-hmm. So let me go ahead and push even farther on this. You take the example of Nero, or you could even boost this up to, you know, Hitler or any other Stalin, or, you know, pick your most tyrannical tyrant. Is what should individuals do in those extreme situations? And as you might argue, well, you know, maybe in 1775 the issues weren't as extreme as, say, in Hitler's Germany. But let's get a sense for that. Would there have been how would you do a Christian reading of Hitler's Germany if you were a Christian in that regime at that time?
Well, the fundamental principle is that believers must obey the government unless or until it requires disobedience to God. Then, and only then, we must disobey, but remain in subjection. There's a difference between subjection and obedience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, in Acts 4 and Acts 5, Peter and John are told to stop preaching the gospel. That's clearly disobedient to God. So they don't obey, but they remain subject to the authorities. Subjection means that you recognize their authority over you, and it means that you remain in subjection even if you have to disobey. And subjection basically usually means that you take the punishment. We have the example of Daniel with the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego with the fiery furnace, the Hebrew midwives, and for that matter, the apostles. Paul wrote to the Romans from jail because he had to keep preaching the gospel, even though the authorities told him not to. But instead of organizing an army and rebelling, he remained in subjection, just as Jesus did in John 19:11. And so the consistent example of Scripture is that you obey the government unless they ask you to disobey God. At that point, you must disobey, but not take up arms, not rebel, but remain in subjection. And so in the case of Hitler's Germany, if Hitler asks you to participate in murdering Jews, then you would disobey. But that doesn't mean that you then pick up arms and rebel. You rely on a sovereign God who has a plan, and he will see that his plan is carried out. And all we're asked to do is to obey, not to handle results. Just like Gideon, for example, it seemed irrational for him and a group of 300 guys to take on 350,000 guys and only carry a pitcher and a torch. But that's what God told him to do. He did it, they did it, and God handled the results.
Okay, so we're talking here, if I understand you correctly, a passive resistance. That, again, if Hitler says, you shall pick up arms and go murder Jews, you say, no, I'm not going to do that. And just like Paul, I suffer the consequences. I go to prison or something much worse, right?
Right.
Okay. So let's then put this into the terms of the American context in 1775, 1776. Now, there are a number of pastors who are arguing the case, and I want to get at this issue of, you know, subjection and obedience here, sift that out a little bit more. There are people like Whitfield, who a decade before the shots were fired at Lexington and Concord were saying, hey, you look across the sea and this English government's getting more and more tyrannical. They're going to take away our religious liberty, and our religious liberty is what we use to preach the word of God. Is that a point where you would say, okay, now we can go into a situation of disobedience? And what would that look like in that context?
It would look just like it did in Acts 4 and 5 for Peter and John, which is you go out and you continue to preach the gospel. And if they arrest you for it, or Daniel, you continue to pray to God rather than to the king. And if they arrest you, then you take the consequences. It's exactly the same situation. So if the government is trying to tell you you can't preach the gospel, then or let's say today that the government decides that you can't say homosexuality is a sin from the pulpit, and a minister believes that God expects him to do that, then he should disobey the law and continue to preach what God would have him preach, and then take the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so an issue of civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Let me just mention this too. In the founding era, they talked a lot about Moses and the Israelites as an example, but you know, Moses did not organize or lead a revolutionary army. All he did was speak God's words and then watch God act. He didn't do the plagues. He didn't kill anybody other than the guy he killed when he was leaving Egypt. But as far as when he was freeing Israel, he didn't even disobey. He obeyed Pharaoh's order to take the Israelites and leave in Exodus 12, 31, and 32. And it was not about political freedom. I can list a dozen verses in which every time he asked for was to go out and worship the Lord, and ultimately that's what Pharaoh tells him to do in chapter 12, verse 31. You go out and worship the Lord, and so that's not even a rebellion or a revolution.
So I can kind of see where you're going with this, but my next question is going to be, again, related to the American situation in 1775. Shots were fired at Lexington, Concord. It's debated who made the first shot. If it was the British who shot first and started coming in and killing colonists, that couldn't be justified under just war theory as a defensive reaction that, hey, we have to push back a little bit here because, you know, they're killing our women and children and that.
Well, they didn't kill their women and children, but aside from that, they're the police force. They have authority. The soldiers, you know, it's hard for us to think of that today because we have separate armies and police forces. But they were the police force. And you had a group of people who were collecting arms illegally, and it made threatening noises. What if we had that today? We have situations with militias in Montana or wherever. Mm-hmm. And the authorities go in and they shut it down. It's exactly the same thing. Because it's the police power of the state. That's their power as the authorities.
Let me then again ask you, and this is a what we in social sciences call a counterfactual, that if we go back and we replay history a little bit and we think about it, logical progression based upon the knowledge that we have of how humans behave, what would you think would have come about had the colonists not responded with a rebellion or a revolution following Lexington and Concord? What if they said, okay, this is too much, we're just going to put down arms? Do you think there ever would have been a independence? Would it have come a decade later, 50 years later? What do you think would have happened if they would have followed the biblical prescriptions to lay down your swords and not resist?
Well, that's a very interesting question, which is rarely asked, and I'm glad you did ask it. What happened with Australia, with Canada, with New Zealand, with other parts of the British Empire? Ultimately, not immediately, but ultimately they became separate, sovereign, independent countries. And arguably, exactly the same thing would happen. But aside from that speculation historically, from my theological perspective, which I don't know if you share it or not, I would argue that if it was God's plan for the United States to become a separate country, then the British would not be able to stop that, because God is sovereign and he's more powerful than George III. And so by whatever means, the United States would have become a nation, because that was God's plan.
I'm going to get into a theological debate that is always I've always struggled with, and this is this issue of free will. And as you're saying, well, if it was God's plan that the United States would become an independent state, well, what if it was God's plan that we did rise up and rebel?
It was, because everything that happens is God's plan. So okay. We now know that it was God's plan. However, that doesn't justify it. God uses the sin of people, sinful acts, in order to accomplish his plan. It was God's plan that Judas betray Christ, but that doesn't make it a good thing. It was God's plan that Adam sin in the garden, but it's the first sin. And so to say that it was God's plan is simply to say that it's God's plan. It's not to say that is what we should do. God uses men's sinful acts to accomplish his plan, but the end doesn't justify the means, at least according to Romans 3:8.
Yeah. Okay. Let me close off. We have a few minutes left here, and if you want to raise any additional points, feel free to do that. But in terms of this, what you seem to be laying out is a very strong pacifist argument. Are there conditions, and what would those conditions be, where you would take up arms for some cause?
Well, pacifism and revolution are two entirely different issues.
Okay, go ahead and discuss that. That'd be good.
Because, again, as I said, war and revolution are two separate issues. Wars are fought between separate countries who do not have authority over one another. They are independent authorities that are on an equal terms. But a revolution is someone trying to usurp the authority that God has established over them and try to remove the authority that God has put over them and declare it illegitimate. And it's really to rebel against God, as Romans 13:2 says. Those who do it have opposed the ordinance of God, and that's not just a New Testament principle. In Numbers 17, verses 5 and 10, God says, when they rebel against you, they're rebelling against me. And that's because God has ordained these authorities. And so revolution, rebellion is an entirely separate case from just plain warfare.
Mm-hmm. Is this a prescription, though, for Christians just to be completely milquetoast and just fall to our knees for any authority?
Not at all. As I said, okay. if the authority asks you to disobey God, then yeah. You should disobey. You should do so robustly, like the three guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did, like Daniel did, except the Hebrew midwives. In many ways, I would argue that it takes a stronger person to be able to do that than to do what seems more convenient or is more likely, you think, to protect your own life, which is to take up arms and fight. Arguably, it takes more courage to do the opposite. I mean, as for Jesus' example, Jesus could have called several thousand angels and not been crucified, too. So was he milquetoast for not doing that, or was he simply being obedient to God? And that's the bottom line, is obedience to God, and then God handles the results. Too often men try to come up with their own clever schemes and be smarter than God, but God has has everything worked out, and all he asks of us is to be obedient, and he handles the results.
And I think that is a good place to leave off here as we come up to the 20-minute timeline that we gave all of our guests the opportunity to speak their position here. And I actually learned a lot from this. This is a great discussion to be having. And so, Greg, I want to thank you for being on our special edition of Research on Religion.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Representing the yes to our general debate question, we have Professor Jonathan Den Hartog, an associate professor of history at Northwestern College in St. Paul, Minnesota. Professor Den Hartog is a graduate of Notre Dame and Hillsdale College and will be a visiting fellow at the James Madison Program in American Institutions and Ideals at Princeton University this coming year. He is currently working on a book manuscript that is tentatively entitled Patriotism and Piety, Federalist Politics and Religious Struggle in the New Nation. We look forward to that coming out. Jonathan, welcome to this special edition of Research on Religion.
Well, thanks, Tony. I'm very glad to be with you today.
Okay, so I should note before we start that Jonathan has admitted not being an unambiguous yes to our question, but was more than happy to argue in favor of this position for the sake of our podcast. So, Jonathan, I pose this question to you. As a Christian in the American colonies, would you have picked up arms against King George in Britain to fight for independence following the battles at Lexington and Concord in April 1775?
Right. Well, thanks for pointing out that I don't have to be unambiguous in this. So just a quick caveat, and that is I'm a historian by training, and so very often what's important to me is getting into the heads of the people who did pick up arms. And it's very clearly many did. And so I think part of my presentation will be to try to understand why they did that. And I think it will make more sense about why it was so compelling for them. They didn't have the luxury of debating this. They had to make a decision. And so I think when we understand that, it will make things a little bit more clear.
I think that's a good point to be made right there, because, you know, some 235 years later, we can sit in our intellectual parlors and debate these issues. But, you know, they saw soldiers marching, they saw soldiers being quartered in their house, and a decision had to be made. And it generally had to be a yes or no. That ambiguous, squishy ground might not have been that easy of an option back then.
The kind of squishy middle disappeared quickly between 1775 and 1776-77. On that ground, let me just point out, I hope that Mark Hall will bring up John Jay, who was one of the key authors of the Olive Branch Petition, which was one of those last gasp attempts at finding a solution. But as we know, it didn't work. That said, so with all that aside, should Christians have done that? I'm going to say yes. They should have reached above their fireplace and grabbed their flintlock musket, or if they were on in the back country of Virginia or Pennsylvania, they should have grabbed their long rifle and headed for the field. Okay. Now, first of all, you could say they could do this simply on a political level, right? That many of them can talk about these issues almost previous to any type of biblical or scriptural engagement. So very often you see this is a political debate. Let's be clear on that. The revolution is a political move. And in it, they're very much concerned about all of the rights of Englishmen, whether that's, you know, no taxation without representation, or you know, the right to have habeas corpus or others. They see this as a political question. And so for many of them in the first year of fighting, really, they're going out to conserve what they have. And they are fighting to preserve what they believe are English rights. Many of them don't talk about American rights or some sort of natural rights right away. They're trying to conserve what they have.
So if I understand you correctly, they are fighting for broader principles that they see extending across the pond, across the Atlantic Ocean, and not just for their own selfish material interests.
the colonists see themselves as sharing in the rights of Englishmen, which they see themselves as full citizens, and consequently those rights which have been enunciated in Magna Carta, in the English Bill of Rights in 1690, have articulated, and so they're fighting for the principle. And it's interesting that those principles pop up in this imperial conflict as early as 1763 with the Stamp Act crisis. So they've actually been debating and advocating for those rights for over a decade before fighting actually breaks out.
Okay. So there is some background to this, that it's not just a decision that's made in 1775. It dates back to 1763 Stamp Act, but even before then, almost a century, dating back to the English Bill of Rights and the Glorious Revolution, I would assume.
I think we need to put in the Glorious Revolution, in which Protestants stood up for their rights as citizens against a Catholic king, James mm-hmm. II. And so this was one template that many in the Revolution used to think about what they were doing, that they were standing up for their rights against someone who would remove them. Going back even further, many New Englanders who are in this look back to the English Civil War, in which Puritans were willing to behead a king, Charles I, when he has stepped out of line and abused their political rights as citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people who see themselves as heirs of the Puritans, now some were better heirs than others, but they saw themselves as heirs, and so they drew even on that memory to craft this kind of long-standing idea of English Protestants defending English political rights.
Mm-hmm. So how would one work in the issue of Christianity here? Did these Puritans see the English Civil War and the Glorious Revolution as moral crusades that they could build upon, and that indeed in 1775 they were just within this longer tradition?
The way many people talked about it was having seen the categories of religious liberty and civil liberty as linking and almost as identified. And I think that's an important insight, that when they talk about civil liberties, there many Christians are also thinking about their religious liberties.
Mm-hmm.
And going along with this, there's this belief that if Parliament, who they don't grant as legitimate, has the right to take away their civil liberties, then very quickly they could go and start taking away their religious liberties. Okay, now we might say, well, that sounds paranoid. But in the minds of these colonists, those issues are very much linked. And in fact, many people had drawn these linkages. Two examples. One, it comes from the great evangelist George Whitefield. Okay, Whitefield is probably the most famous person of the late colonial period. And in 1764, he tells some American colonists, there is a deep-laid plot against your civil and religious liberties. Okay, so he is starting to warn people, and this concern is only going to grow over the coming years. Okay.
And so this is a full decade plus before yes. Lexington and Concord. So you're making the case here that Lexington and Concord, what occurs afterwards, is not just a rash decision. There's something leading up to this.
There has been a lot of thought and debate. And mm-hmm. and so the people who get drawn into the conflict right after Lexington and Concord have been thinking about this for a long time.
Okay. So your first example is George Whitefield, 1764,
mm-hmm. Right. My second is John Witherspoon, okay? Witherspoon, who's a Scot, he grew up in Scotland, he's been a minister in Scotland, he comes over to the New World to be the president of Princeton College. So I'll have to do a little communing with the spirit of Witherspoon this coming year.
Yep.
But in early 1776, spring of 1776, he preaches a very important sermon called The Dominion of Providence Over the Passions of Men. And he points to this, and he says, your American cause is just. And why, he says, the cause of America is the cause of justice, liberty, and human nature. And then he says, why? He says, it has not been the effect of pride, resentment, or sedition. In other words, you know, this is not just arrogance, this is not just rebellion against constituted authorities. But rather, he says, the movement grows from a deep and general conviction that our civil and religious liberties are depending on this issue. So Witherspoon is also connecting the civil political liberties and the religious liberties. And so many American Christians saw it, and at least partially I can say rightfully saw those two things as linked.
Mm-hmm. Now let me ask you about this threat, because oftentimes threats can be whipped up into frenzies that are really out of whack with what reality is. Did the colonists really have it that bad? I mean, when you take a look back in 1775 and you compare them to their English counterparts living on the British Isles, you're saying, hey, you know, they got lower rates of taxation. They got the opportunity for self-governance, and it's a, you know, long way across that ocean. So it's not like somebody's always constantly spying on you. You have your, you know, town councils that you have your colonial governments. You guys got it pretty good. What could you possibly be complaining about?
It's that point about self-government that I think was so significant, that Americans had a tradition of self-government, and then they believed it was being threatened. Their feeling after the French and Indian War was that the British were trying a unilateral reworking of imperial policies. That, you know, the colonial establishment had worked fine. They were happy with self-government and their protected rights as Englishmen. However, when the British government and Parliament started to change the grounds of the discussion, the grounds of that government, they immediately said, ah, here's a problem. We need to stand up against it. And if I can pull just one other quote, this comes from one of my favorite articulate people who was actually at the Battle of Lexington and Concord, a private by the name of Levi Preston. He came from the town of Danvers. And later in life, he was interviewed, and the interviewer said, well, why did you go to the battle? And he said, you know, was it the stamp tax? Was it the tea tax? He says, no. You know, and this is, what was it? He said, the interviewer said, well, what have you been reading, right? Were you reading Harrington or Locke? And Levi says, no, the only books we had were the Bible, the Catechism, and Watts's Psalms and Hymns. And I think that's a very interesting aside. But then, so what is the question the interviewer asked? Preston says, young man, what we meant in going for those redcoats was this. We always had governed ourselves, and we always meant to. They didn't mean we should. And so it really was over this battle of self-government coupled with religious liberty issues. Further, the Americans were very touchy. Because they felt their liberties were not entirely secure, they went out of their way to protect them. And in fact, one of their other counselors, a man by the name of John Dickinson, who doesn't sign the Declaration of Independence, has been warning for years in his letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania. One of his great mottos is, oppose a disease at its beginning. And what these Americans were saying is, if we don't resist these encroachments now, they will continue to grow and we won't be able to stop them. So this is a matter of nipping the abuse of power in the bud for the Americans.
Why didn't John Dickinson sign the Declaration of Independence?
Dickinson's a fascinating character because he's at the Continental Congress. He's involved in the debates. He's made a name as one of the strongest resistors of British abuses. His letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania is saying how bad the Townshend duties are. So why not? Well, it appears that his Quaker thought, his mother-in-law and wife were both Quakers, and he appears to have adopted a Quaker attitude towards a type of Quaker constitutionalism, as the historian Jane Calvert has called it, that he's not willing to make the break. Although, here again, Dickinson is unusual. Rather than leaving, as many loyalists do, he doesn't sign, but he sticks around in America. He actually works for the Patriot cause. And after the war is over, he comes out in favor of the U.S. Constitution. So even though he himself can't support that actual rupture, he goes along with it and then seeks to nurture kind of a prudent government in the new United States.
Now, you mentioned he comes from a Quaker background, so you can see that would be somewhat of an uphill struggle for him to pick up arms, being that they have a pacifist theology. But what about others? And I want to go back to what you were talking about, this guy, Levi Preston, who was at Lexington and Concord. And he had mentioned the only thing we have is the Bible and this hymnal. And, you know, also during this period of time, there were a number of preachers, especially in New England, preaching from the pulpit saying the tyrannical government across the seas is unjust. Was there any way that Christians found to justify their actions according to just war theory?
Yeah. At least two sermons that I've run across, and hat tip to John Fia for pointing these out to me, but at least two of them defend the war as a defensive war. And I realize that's not a, I actually want to go into full just war theory in a second, but at least two of them, one minister by the name of John Carmichael, who's a Presbyterian, and then a Baptist by the name of David Jones, argue that what the revolution is a defensive war. Carmichael preaches a sermon called A Self-Defensive War is Lawful. And then Jones says, a defensive war is sinless before God. So rather than seeing themselves as revolting against proper authority, they see themselves, what they're telling their congregations is that they're defending themselves. And I do think this is an important component. Why do so many people pick up arms, right? Why do they grab their muskets in later 1775? Because it's gone from a political conflict to a military conflict, and it's happening on the, you know, at their doors. And so even a level of love for your neighbor would demand the defense of home and community. And so ministers really are putting that forward, that this is why it's justified, is because it's defensive.
I was going to say, from your historian perspective, and again, you're being asked to justify this position, and as I mentioned at the outset, you are not unambiguously in favor of picking up arms in April 1775. Do you see that argument that this is a defensive war and hence a just war as being a valid argument with, you know, a couple centuries of hindsight?
With all the caveats, ultimately I think I do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's this moment that many, this is the point between 75 and 76 that people go from, you know, we're not sure, we're staying on the fence, to strongly supporting the move that will ultimately go to independence, right? That they have been attacked, that, you know, although people still debate who fired at the first shot at Lexington, very clearly the British are the aggressors there. The British are the ones who are making the shows of force, and the colonists feel, and I think rightfully so, that they are defending themselves.
Well, let me ask this in the minute or so that we have left. You mentioned earlier on about John Jay and the olive branch position that is extended. And why not that? Why not say, hey, yeah, the British are the aggressors, but, you know, as Christians, we got to turn the other cheek and, you know, maybe we should just wait this out and see if there are other diplomatic solutions before we get all lathered up with our firearms.
And I mean, and some people are thinking that way, but, you know, in hindsight, we do know what happened with the olive branch petition. The king wouldn't even receive it. By that point, by the time fighting has broken out, the king has hired Hessian mercenaries. He's declared the colonists out of his protection. He has also forced the issue. So within a couple of months, people don't have that option. And so, you know, you can say, what are they looking at? They're saying, well, war is the last resort. By this point, it really is. War is defensive. They're holding that up. And the other kind of component about just war theory is, that I think we should work in is the war, would be sanctioned by proper authorities. Obviously not the British authorities, but let's also give the American colonists credit for having established other structures of governmental authority, through the Continental Congress and through their, state, their colonial, assemblies. So these are not just people deciding for themselves individually to go out and do it, but there are structures in society who are legitimating this. And of course, the Congress legitimates this when they send, they say, hey, we need a general to lead this. And they ultimately select General George Washington, who's going to go out and go up to Boston to guide the troops from there on out.
And so as you argue that there was a great deal of thoughtful process behind this decision to pick up arms and go to war, and that Christians could have justified it through all these different positions that you make. And I think that those thoughtful pieces that you leave us with will linger on, and we'll see what others have to say in this debate. Jonathan, I want to thank you for being on this very special edition of Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much.
Here to speak definitively for the squishy middle, we have Professor Mark David Hall, Professor of Political Science at George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon. Mark has been the guest twice before on our podcast and is quickly becoming the Will Smith of Research on Religion, meaning that he is guaranteed to appear in a blockbuster interview every Independence Day. Only Rod Stark has appeared more often on our podcast. Professor Hall is the author of numerous books, including The Founders on God and Government, America's Forgotten Founders, The Forgotten Founders on Religion and Public Life, and the forthcoming book, Roger Sherman and the Creation of the American Republic. Mark, welcome to this special edition of Research on Religion.
Hi, thanks so much, Tony.
Okay, you know what the rules are, and here's the question that everybody gets. As a Christian in the American colonies, would you have picked up arms against King George and Britain to fight for independence following the battles at Lexington and Concord in April 1775?
That's a great question, Tony, and I will eventually get around to answering it. But what I think I'd like to do is divide the question up a little bit. And I'd like to begin by asking, can a Christian ever participate in a revolution? Because if the answer is no, then by definition, of course, a Christian shouldn't have participated in the war for independence. Now, my position is yes, it is sometimes permissible for a Christian to attempt to overthrow a civic authority. And in making that argument, I have to admit that the church historically for, 13 to 1500 years or so is pretty firmly on the side of the no answer to that question. They were, Christian thinkers would read passages such as Romans 13 and others and say, civic authority is ordained by God and Christians have to submit to it. Now, if the civic authority orders you to disobey God directly, to bow down and worship Baal, you obviously refuse to do that, but then you take the consequences. And we have good biblical stories of Daniel being thrown into the lion's den and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the fiery furnace. And so I can see there's an argument to be made for that position. And so if that's your position, if that's how you understand the Holy Scriptures, as a good Christian, and particularly a good Protestant, then you just have to sort of hunker down and accept whatever civic authority is over you. And, of course, you refuse to obey the civic authority if it tells you to disobey God directly, but otherwise you grin and bear it, perhaps pray for a change, but that's it. However, there was a very important shift that came about with the Protestant Revolution, and the shift has antecedents among Catholic thinkers beginning as early as the 12th century, maybe the 13th century or so, that the thinkers started saying, well, what sort of government is Romans 13 talking about? Is it talking about anything that passes itself off for government, or perhaps is it only talking about certain types of government, legitimate government versus an illegitimate government, a just government versus an unjust government? And so these thinkers started floating ideas such as tyrannicide, that it might be permissible for Christian civic authorities anyway, inferior magistrates to kill a tyrant that was over them.
So what you're saying, let me break in here a minute. So what you're saying is it's not that these Christian thinkers are rethinking Romans 13 that says you must subject yourself to legitimate authority. They're starting to rethink what is the definition of legitimate authority.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. So with the Protestant Reformation, you have folks like John Calvin come along, and in his Institutes, he says there may be situations where inferior magistrates would resist superior magistrates if they act in an unjust fashion. But, sometimes people, point to Calvin and say, there it is. There's hardly any room even within the Reformed tradition. But even as Calvin was arguing that, you had John Knox in Scotland saying, no, it's a Christian's duty, and not just the inferior magistrates, but actually the citizen's duty to resist, to overthrow a tyrant, to resist or overthrow an unjust magistrate. And Knox is followed by Beza and Goodman and Poney and Buchanan and a whole host of folks. And what they did, if you read Romans 13, the first couple of verses, you see things like in Romans 13:3. I'll just quote it here. For rulers hold no terror to those who do right, but for those who do wrong. So the obvious question is, well, what if you have someone who purports to be a ruler, but he is a terror for those who do right, and he rewards those who do wrong? That might not be the sort of government that Romans 13 is talking about. So the unjust ruler perhaps is not the sort of ruler that we're talking about in Romans 13. Let me give you another example. I'd be interested to hear what, say, Greg Fraser would say about this. Let's say right now, I think we can all concede that Christians have a Romans 13 obligation to obey Congress and President Obama and the Supreme Court. But what if President Obama today declared himself dictator for life and he abolished Congress? Would we have a Romans 13 obligation to obey him? And most Christian thinkers, I think, would say no. He's exceeded the scope of his legitimate authority, and we no longer have a Romans 13 obligation to obey him. So what we see within the Reformed tradition is this resistance ideology is developed and it's magnified, and these guys, remember, are facing hostile regimes. The Huguenots in France are wiped out. Where Protestants succeed, they tend to succeed by force of arms. And so what you have is this group of people who understand the Bible to allow for resistance to tyrannical authority. And this is particularly relevant for the War for Independence, but because by the late 18th century, something like up to 75% of Americans are reasonably classified as Reformed or Calvinist Christians. And so they come from a long tradition that says, watch out for tyranny. And when a tyrant approaches, it's appropriate to resist this tyrant. And it's appropriate to resist a tyrant by force if necessary.
So let me ask you about the issue of being a tyrannical government. So you make another reference to Romans 13:3, and we can now start to debate the issue of whether a government is really tyrannical or not. And so that's going to be a key point here, I think, in this debate. I should also note that your response seems to be in reference to Greg Fraser, but you have not heard his response yet. So I'm sure
that's
that you heard it at Gordon College, so you kind of have an idea. So don't want.
Yeah, he and I go way back. We've had a long friend. Debate. So I know his position pretty
and
well.
We continue it here. But let's get to this issue of tyranny and take us to 1775. And does King George III in Britain represent that kind of tyranny that Romans 13:3 would be talking about? Because when you take a look at this in historical perspective, the colonists had some complaints about taxation without representation. But you know what? They were actually probably better off than many of the citizens in the homeland, in Britain itself. They had their own town councils. They had a relatively free amount of expression in their colonies. The taxation didn't seem to be overburdensome in any way, shape, or form. So, come on, what's their beef?
That's a great question. And one thing I was trying to do is paint the picture of this people that is very sensitive to threats of tyranny. And I'll take you back to 1765. If I may, with the Stamp Act. What you have here is a constitutional point. A good number of the colonists, and certainly a number of the colonial leaders, certainly the Patriot leaders, were very convinced that the British Empire was set up with a particular set of constitutional arrangements. And that is that you have England, and you have Parliament in England, and the Parliament reasonably governs England because the people in England have consented to be governed by Parliament. And then you have Virginia over here. And Virginia is governed by the House of Burgesses, and the people in Virginia consent to be governed by the House of Burgesses. What holds everyone together is the king. So Virginia has an allegiance to the king, Maryland has an allegiance to the king, England has an allegiance to the king. So the problem with the Stamp Act and the Sugar Act and some of these things is, for the first time, Parliament says, we're going to tax the people of Virginia. And the people of Virginia say, this is impermissible. You simply don't have that authority. Folks like James Otis recognize this is a very small tax, but the size of the tax doesn't matter. There is no authority for Parliament to tax the American people. An analogy I give my students sometimes is this. If Canada, the government of Canada, passed a tax, every American had to pay $1 to Canada each year. That's hardly any money, right? Most of us could pay that and not miss it. But how many Americans would pay that very small tax? I would hope almost none, right? Because the government of Canada has absolutely no authority to tax American citizens. And we would very reasonably ask, if we start paying this tax just because it's small, what's going to happen next year? It might be $100. Then 2 years later, it's going to be $1,000. And then before we know it, the United States of America will be governed by Canada. And with that sort of power, that sort of unchecked power, we could be subject to tyranny. So the size of the tax doesn't matter. Parliament, you know, the colonists resist, and Parliament backs off. But in one of the most foolish acts of the era, in 1766, it passed the Declaratory Act, which said, okay, fine, we'll remove some of these duties and taxes, but we reserve the right to do whatever we darn well please. That's what the Declaratory Act said. And to the colonists, this is a declaration of tyranny. A government without limitations is a tyrannical government, whether it chooses to exercise its power or not. So I think, you know, Parliament's just doing all the wrong things, and it's very much scaring the colonists. And then you have a series of other events, some of which go to issues that are far more important to Americans that era. You have a lot of serious discussion about the possibility of sending a bishop to America and installing ecclesiastical courts, which is seen as a threat to religious liberty. You have things like the Quebec Act, which is seen as a betrayal of the Protestant cause. You later, of course, have the township duties, that's the Quartering Act. And so Parliament's engaged in a series of actions that seem to be part of a pattern of tyranny. So I can understand why the colonists, particularly these reformed colonists, are getting very, very nervous, and they're pushing back against these acts of Parliament. Finally, by 1774, you have folks like James Wilson and John Adams and Thomas Jefferson come out with some very forceful statements saying, look, Parliament has absolutely and utterly no authority whatsoever, internally or externally, over the American colonists. The only authority, the only connection we have to Great Britain is to the king. And that's why by the time you get to the Declaration of Independence, if you read through that, Parliament isn't mentioned, right? It's all aimed at the king. So the argument is the only obligation the people in Virginia, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and so forth have is to the king. And that's an obligation exchange for protection. And the king has removed his protection, so therefore the colonists are justified in rebelling. So that's the patriot position, as I understand it. And I think it's very compatible with traditional Christian ways of thinking about resisting unjust authority.
Okay, so you're setting up the case here to say the colonists were just. And it might not have been on the burdensome nature of the taxation, but rather it's a procedural issue, and we're concerned about the future because Parliament's usurping authority in a tyrannical way. Got that. However, you're making the case here that you probably would not have picked up a musket following the battle at Lexington and Concord. So what is your position here? Because you just seem to make a case. You just convinced me between 1765 and 1775. Man, my blood is really boiling here. So I'm rushing off to the first long rifle I can find. But you're saying, eh, wait a little bit. What's your reasoning here?
Okay, well, Tony, one thing I think is going on here is this. When you ask American Christians in general, was the War for Independence just? Most would say yes. When you ask a subset of American Christians, those academics that have studied the American founding, was the War for Independence just, you perhaps get a bit more hesitant of an answer. In some cases, such as Greg Fraser, I believe his position is revolution's never just. So that makes sense. I suppose a Quaker might give a similar answer. But for the rest of us who do believe that it's sometimes just to resist the tyrannical authority, we have the benefit of hindsight. We can look back at the historical record and we can say there really was no chance that a bishop would be sent to North America. And even if one was, it probably wouldn't really try to crack down on the freedom of Congregationalists and Presbyterians to worship God as their consciences dictate. The Quebec Act perhaps wasn't that big of a deal after all. It certainly wasn't an endorsement of Roman Catholicism. There are legitimate constitutional arguments, but we have that all the time, right? We have constitutional arguments about the legitimacy of Obamacare, but you don't see people picking up the rifles. There's a lot of room here still for discussion, negotiation. Let's try to work things out. War is messy business. Men die, boys die, fathers die. Their widows and orphans are made. And so we want to be really, really careful before we pick up the muskets and start shooting. So I suppose my position would be, with the benefit of hindsight, that there was a lot more room for negotiation here. But I can understand if I was thrust back into the era that I may very well pick up my gun, assuming that I have the same sort of theological and denominational commitments I have now. But I think we have to be real careful, and it bothers me a little bit when these historians are judgmental about the American founders, and I'll tell you why. Most historians would say we have to be real careful of engaging in presentism. We need to be real careful in saying what's so obvious to us today should have been obvious to other folks. And this is sort of a bad analogy, but if I ask you, Tony, was it a good idea to invest in high-tech stocks in 1996? From this position, you're going to say, no, it's a horrible idea because you know about the high-tech bubble crash in 2000. On the other hand, if I'm talking to you in 1995, 1996, you might say, yeah, this is a wave of the future. It's a very reasonable investment. Let's put our money here. And so those poor people that invested in Microsoft and other high-tech stocks in 1996, 97, you know, we should be pretty careful in judging them and saying they were just foolish or they were just greedy, right? No. In the same way, I think we can understand why many American founders thought they were engaged in a just war. I think they had good reasons to think that, but we still might be hesitant. We might say they acted a bit too precipitously and so forth. And we might, I suppose, take lessons from that and apply it to the present age, those of us who are Christians who think about these things, to say when the nation is heading towards war, it's really easy to get caught up in these things, but we should perhaps be a voice of, you know, let's be careful here. Let's make sure all the options are exhausted before we actually pick up our guns and go start shooting people.
Well, let me ask about that, because about a month or so after Lexington and Concord, cooler heads tried to prevail. You had people like John Dickinson drafting up a letter to King George. This became known as the Olive Branch Petition, saying, hey, let's just back off and talk about this a little bit more. But the reaction of Britain and of King George was to ignore this letter, to rip it up and say, hey, you know, no, the die has been cast. So even with that 2020 hindsight, was there little option left in the summer of 1775?
You know, I think there were still options. Again, I'm sympathetic to the Patriot position. I could see that they would see this as yet another black mark against the king. But still, there's room for negotiation. There's room for perhaps economic boycott and that sort of thing. Fortunately, Tony, no one's calling for picking up of arms against the Obama administration. But from my perspective, it seems like the Obama administration is engaged in almost a systematic assault on religious liberty, the contraception mandate and this sort of thing. But fortunately, and again, I want to be very clear, I'm not advocating picking up arms. I think it's much better for those of us who see this as a threat to religious liberty to write letters to, you know, the Catholic Bishops Conference has come out with a powerful statement. Perhaps we end up voting Barack Obama out of office. We elect a different set of political leaders. Even though there are some real threats to religious liberty in America today, there's still such a long way to go before it would be just to pick up arms. I think the colonists were perhaps further down the path towards picking up arms, but I think they still had a way to go. So it's a matter of degree. Unfortunately, there aren't bright lines in this sort of business. It's a matter of prudence. But with the benefit of hindsight, I'd still say there's room for waiting and negotiation.
Well, let me ask you a bit of a counterfactual question here, and this is where us scholars get to replay history on a what-if basis. Mm-hmm. And let me pose it to you. Say the Olive Branch Petition was sent out in June of 1775 or May of 1775, and it was accepted, or there was some response from King George or from Parliament, and they said, okay, let's negotiate this a little while longer. How do you think the American war or cause of independence would have played out over the next several years?
You know, it's interesting. James Wilson in 1774 proposed basically what became, I'm not saying they got it from him, but what became the Commonwealth system, which exists to this day, right? Where you have Canada and Australia and other Commonwealth countries that still have the Queen on their currency. They recognize connection to the monarch. And yet Canada, of course, is completely self-governing, as is Australia and other Commonwealth countries. So this is one thing that Wilson was suggesting in 1774. If that sort of result could have been negotiated, then I suppose today we still might have the monarch on our currency, but I think it's highly likely that America would be, for all intents and purposes, a completely independent country. To the extent to which Great Britain retained any, or the monarch retained any authority, the monarch did have the veto of laws in some colonies. You know, it's interesting to think about, right? Slavery was eliminated in the British Empire in 1832. Gosh, that'd be a great result if it happened in America, right?
Yeah, a couple decades earlier, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that would have been without a bloody civil war. That would be a marvelous thing. You won't like this, but I'll point out that in England, guns are virtually non-existent, right? The government basically confiscated them all, and so there's consequently far fewer gun deaths. You know, conceivably that might be the case in America today. So I think it's highly likely we would have been independent, that this independence could have come without a war, and perhaps there might have been other good benefits, such as the elimination of slavery decades earlier. But we can't know, of course, and that's why historians almost always refuse to engage in such counterfactual questions.
Well, you leave us with a lot of food for thought and your counterfactual example there of what would have happened if we were still under British rule. I think you can buy a 20-ounce soft drink still in London, but you can no longer do that in New York City. I wonder if that would be different. And for those of you folks who are getting ready to go out and celebrate July 4th this weekend, maybe you can pick up a 20-ounce soda if you're not in New York City and celebrate that. So, Mark, I want to thank you for, again, being on this special edition of Research on Religion.
Hey, thank you very much, Tony.
I want to close out this special edition of Research on Religion with my own thoughts on this rather provocative debate. As I noted in the introduction to our podcast, I was of the mind that any good Christian in 1775 should have picked up arms and fought for the patriot cause. However, Greg Fraser really made me pause and think about that position. His argument was rooted in a literal reading of Romans 13 verses 1 to 2 and a few other biblical passages. As a Christian, I would do well to take that into account, as well as his argument that it takes more courage to engage in civil disobedience of authority and then pay the consequences than it is to join a violent rebellion. Greg's argument also got me to wrestle with my own thoughts about predetermination and free will, something that I will fully admit that is still confusing to me. However, I still cannot bring myself to accept a pacifist response to tyranny. I struggled in our discussion with the difference between submitting to a tyrannical authority that you already live under as compared to applying just war theory to a situation of an outside invader. What if an outside force invades your nation, topples the leader, and then makes everyone submit to their tyrannical authority? When does the just war against the foreign invasion, fought on defensive grounds, become a rebellion against established authority? Does this occur when the invader declares himself now to be the sovereign? And who is that invader to claim such authority? This might be God's plan, but again, I struggle with the issue of free will and how we must respond to tyranny. In the case of the American colonists, there certainly wasn't a situation of foreign invasion per se, though the increasing separation of colony and homeland must have certainly made the encroaching involvement in colonial affairs by King George III and Parliament seem like an invasion. They were quartering soldiers in personal homes, after all. If that's not an invasion, I don't know what is. Thus, for me, the line between foreign invasion and encroaching tyranny is not a bright line, as Mark Hall would say. that Mark Hall brings up Romans 13, verse 3, makes what seems like a clear-cut command in verses 1 to 2 a bit more hazy. As such, and based upon what both Mark Hall and Jonathan Den Hartog argued, I would probably stick to my position of picking up arms in April of 1775, especially when I was reminded that the Olive Branch petition of John Dickinson and John Jay was rejected outright by the king a month or so later. And even though I did not change my position, I found this debate to be intellectually stimulating. I hope you did as well. I invite our listeners to post their own thoughts at our website, www.researchonreligion.org, or at our Facebook fan page listed at the top of this episode's specific webpage. Hopefully, we can get our guests to post responses to your comments as well. And hopefully, you will have an enjoyable and safe Independence Day. May God bless and keep you well. Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.